July 15th, 2023, in Nina Underground, Spain. And we're doing Career Dharma Lesson 3, our disposition and our expertise. Everybody has something to write on and something to write with?
Yes.
All righty. Ready? Everybody ready? Okay. So we did a class on the prosperity types, and we talked about defining the fields, explaining the four containers. What are the four fields?
Artistry,
government, resources, ideas. All right. So that was, we were doing quite some things in principle one, connecting our nature to our livelihood. Now this is all part of the big picture of identifying our prosperity type and career field. But now we're going to look a little bit at principle two. So we didn't do everything from principle one. In our book, we go into each of these in much more depth, but we did some of the main things from there. And we're not going to do everything from principle two, but we're going to touch on some main things. And I think that this is also of great interest. Well, how do I figure out which field I go into? Now, some of you probably have some pretty good ideas just from yesterday's class. And here we're going to look again at this famous verse that Krishna says there's four main categories of work. So this is, again, this very famous verse about the four fields. And again, this very important verse that we cannot repress our nature. We can try. We can try. I certainly tried to repress my nature. I thought there were something wrong about it, something bad about it. I talked about that with the prosperity types, yes? How I thought that it was... Why don't you just leave it a little open and... That I was thinking it was bad to be a leader. It wasn't humble or something like that. So I was fighting my own nature for quite some time. But it didn't work. No? Because Krishna says it doesn't work. And he knows what he's talking about. Yes. So we looked at the prosperity types, and remember I told you that this was part of the Gaudiya Math logo. You remember that?
Yeah.
So this is the Gaudiya Math logo. Now my granddaughter drew this, and she modernized the printing press picture, because Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati had an old printing press picture, so she made it here look like a copy machine. And our Srila Prabhupada, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, he has a simplified form of this logo on the gates to our ISKCON property in Sridham, Mayapur. This is a very interesting logo for many reasons, which we will not discuss today. If any of you have Raghunath Das Goswami's Manashiksha, so I produced I didn't do the translation, but I produced translation and commentary on that book. I have a whole chapter in there where I talk about the significance of this logo to bhakti. All right, so let's take those six opulences, and now we're going to put them with fields, and please listen carefully. This is what the fields produce for others, not for the workers. So we first talked about what our job produces for ourselves. And you remember that I made the point that I can produce something for others that I'm not getting. Everybody remembers that? Yes? If I'm picking up the garbage in the street, I'm bringing beauty to others, but I'm not bringing any beauty to myself. In fact, I'm getting very dirty. So I can be doing something that provides these opulences for others. So this is about what feels... provide what opulence is for society, not for the workers in the fields necessarily. And there's some overlap here. It's not an absolute. Okay. So you remember that I talked about the difference between expertise and inclination. So here you see an expert. Yeah? You all know who this guy is? Mr. Bolt. What a name. So he's an expert. When we read in the Shastra about the qualities of the people who belong in each of the four fields, we're reading about these people. We're reading about Dharmic experts. And that fact creates some confusion. And I noticed that confusion coming out in some of the questions and discussions. Right? Like somebody, he's not here, he brought up about organized crime. So organized crime is a form of government, but it's a messed up form of government. It doesn't have any expertise in Dharma. It's messing up the Dharma. Yes? So when we're going to look at what field should I be in, we make a mistake if we compare ourselves to the Dharmic expert. Like if you want to find out if you should be a runner, you don't see, am I as good as Mr. Bolt? Then pretty much you'll say no. Everybody follow this? Yes? What we're looking for is this. Do I have the initial inclination for that field? And that might look a little different from the Dharmic expertise. Is everybody with me? Okay, now you see I put in the corner of this slide, see I put this little picture of a baby walking? So any slides where I have this picture, that's referring to the beginning inclination rather than the Dharmic expertise. So as we go through the fields, I'd like you to make some notes on these things. Especially what values are important to you in your work, because the fields are about values, and what potential inclinations do I have? Now, the next thing I'm going to say, you might find sad or unfortunate or discouraging, but it's very important. Many times when people look at what is my inclination, they're looking for what am I good at and I love? What am I good at and I love and makes me feel happy? Now, that is the way we will feel when we are in our right field. But there's a few important things to remember. First of all, most of us can find a way to be good at entertainment, and we enjoy entertainment or recreation. You all know in the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that one should be balanced in eating, sleeping, working, and recreation. You're familiar with this verse? Yes? So Krishna is distinguishing between our career and our recreation. We all need to do things to relax. So a lot of us, I mentioned this briefly before, a lot of us are going to have hobbies that look like artistry. Most hobbies look like artistry. There are some hobbies that look like ideas, like people like to do word puzzles. You know, they like to pay, what is that new one, Wordle? I don't know how that works, but like Wordle and Scrabble and crossword puzzles. So there's people who may be in the field of resources who love to play Scrabble to relax. There's people in the field of government that grow a garden to relax or do woodworking projects to relax. And all of us relax with entertainment. And today, entertainment is a big thing in many of our lives, much bigger than it was for most of human history. So before television and radio and recorded music, entertainment had to be live. So that was usually in the evenings, people got together and there was storytelling, or maybe there was a drama, or maybe there was a puppet show, maybe there was live music. People often learned how to play a musical instrument and made their own music. Yes, but now that, I mean, when I was a young child, there were only four television stations. They were in black and white, and they were only on in the day. And it was all live. It was all cartoons or live. Nothing pre-recorded. So nowadays, how many stations are, I don't even know how many channels there are. Hundreds and hundreds, yes? Thousands? So thousands of channels. Plus, if you talk about all the consumer-created things, like, why don't we leave that open so we get some air? Like YouTube. I mean, one can be, I've read that the average American watches 6 hours of television a day, which I find inconceivable. I don't understand how a person earns their money and eats and sleeps and takes a shower and watches that much television every day. So, you know, I've seen people play computer games for 12 or 15 hours a day. I've actually seen this. You know, so somebody may be very good at a computer game and they're really enjoying it and they can just be in the zone. And they're thinking, well, that should be my work. I should have my livelihood playing computer games. So you want to be very careful that we don't think about recreation and entertainment as, oh, that's something I love and I'm good at. Is that everybody is clear about that? Also, you want to be careful about a hobby. Like a person might love to have a garden as their hobby, they can relax, but they wouldn't necessarily want a career as a gardener. Yeah? Okay, or a person might like to go swimming as their hobby, but they wouldn't want to be a swim teacher or professional swimmer. So the other problem is that we don't often know what we love and what we're good at if we haven't had training in it. Does that also make sense to everybody? Like, I might be a really expert chef, but if no one's ever taught me how to cook, and I've never spent any time in a kitchen, I might not even know that I could be very good at it. And it's hard to love something you're not good at. Let's leave it open so we get some air, please. Maybe, why don't you prop it open with something, and that way I don't have to keep saying that all the time. You can, yeah. That doesn't affect this very much, does it?
No.
No. Okay, so you can prop it open with the fan, and then we can just leave it open and have the fan blowing. And okay, great. This is something I learned myself the hard way, that if we don't have training in something, we never have an opportunity to find out if we're actually good at it. And until we're good at something, it's hard to love it. Is this all making sense to people? Because a lot of people just think, what am I good at that I love? That's their first question. And the answer may be watching TV. You know? That's not it. Building Legos, you know? That's not it. And the other thing is, what became my career is something that I was not good at first because I didn't have any training in it. All right, so we clear with those caveats? Okay, so it's not so simple. It's simple, but it's not simple. The main thing that we want to look at is, right, we talked about how Krishna said it can't be repressed. What do I do that can't be repressed? That I can't stop doing? I can't be rewarded out of it. I can't be punished out of it. It's something that I do. And my dear friends, this is not easy to recognize. What is it I just do? And we want to look at what do I just do in terms of my values? What dharma am I working for? Again, those two questions from each field. In artistry, what are the questions? Is my work what? Beautiful and supportive. In resources, what are the two questions? Is it sustainable and regenerative. In government, what are the two questions? Is it just and honorable? And in ideas, is it true and wise? We want to look at what are our values, because this is indicative of our dharma. Okay, let's start this time with the field of resources. Okay, do you love to play? What's the thing you like to play with? Do you like to play with making money? Like to play with the land and expanding things, right? Do you like to stay on top of ways of earning more money? No, everybody likes to earn some money. Nobody wants to be without money. Well, nobody, but let's say nobody. And especially when you're young and you're living at home, everyone wants some money because it represents freedom and independence. If I have some money, then I can buy things and do things on my own. I'm not dependent on my parents. So most children and young people like to do something to earn money. But we're talking about really liking to earn money. Now, remember I told you about my youngest son who's in the field of resources? So when he was 7 years old, he started a business selling school supplies to the other Gurukul students. I mean, my husband had to help him because he was only seven. But, you know, my husband would have this catalog of, like, pencils and pens and erasers and notebooks and rulers. And, you know, my son, Keshava, he would figure out what he wanted to get. And then my husband would buy it. And then Keshava would sell it as a mark with a markup. So he would be making a profit. And then once he got a little older, he started making prasadam. He would make fresh orange juice. He would get the oranges, make orange juice, freeze it, and then we would show the Mahabharata or Ramayana every Sunday at the Gurukula. In those days, we were the only ones who had like a big screen and projector. So all the devotees after the Sunday feast would come to our house for videos, and then he would sell them prasadam. He would sell them the orange juice popsicles, and then he expanded to like cheesecake and things like that. So he's always thinking like this, always looking at how to make money and how to make a profit. Yes? Staying on top of and seeing everything in that way. Srila Prabhupada talks about the people with this nature, how he says they will make money when the market's going up and they will make money when the market's going down. And he tells one story, which we have in our book, about this man who said, yes, I'm a businessman. And someone said, I'm a businessman, but I want a loan. And the person said, if you're really a businessman, you don't need a loan. You'll find a way of making your own capital. And he said, how can I do that? He said, there's a dead mouse, that's your capital. And the man, there was something in the government at that time, they were paying money for dead mice, whoever was collecting. So he got like, you know, a couple pennies for his mouse. And he invested that, and eventually became very wealthy. So thinking like this. And remember about being always thirsty, yes? The Bhagavatam says people in this field are always thirsty. The field of resources and the field of government are expansive types. They want to expand. They want to grow. They think big. They want to get big. They want to get bigger. How to improve? How to expand? In quantity or quality or both? They tend to be high risk takers. They have a lot of drive. They're very goal-oriented and not very process-oriented. They're very goal-oriented and not very process-oriented. Again, tending to put projects over people. So these are some of the initial tendencies that we can see. All right, now going to the dharmic expertise. Systems thinkers. Thinking about systems. But they're a particular system. They're a particular resources system. They're not big, 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 big. So if they're working with the land and the animals, they can feel the whole system of the seasons, the natural production schedules of plants and animals. their competitors in the marketplace. They get a sense of the whole picture. And I have one devotee friend who runs a dairy farm. And he just sort of personifies this ability. I mean, and he's able to run a successful dairy farm, interestingly enough, although he doesn't even own any land. He has a huge herd of cows, and what he does is he makes arrangements with people who own land. He says, you let me graze my cows on your land, and they'll, you know, keep your fields clear. They'll take care of the weeds and like that. And he has this whole system by which he's able to, he's constantly expanding. He's always like getting more cows and involving more people. And, you know, he's definitely not cash rich, but he is very, very prosperous. He's also very much expanding his preaching about cow care. And the flows that these people understand, again, we're talking about dharmic expertise, are resources and money. These are the things that they can understand, that they're grasping, they're getting. How does it go there? What are the distribution networks? I have one devotee friend whose testimony is in our book for this field, and she's retired. She's in the process of retiring, but she ran several boutique shops, and in her boutique shops, 50% of the clothing she designed personally. And she would learn who to work with. Like, she tried working with people in India. She was in Australia. She tried working with people in India and China and different parts of China and different parts of India, and she would find where she could source the fabric and where she could source the workers to make things in the right way and how she could transport it. You understand? To understand how these things are flowing. Now, what these people want to do is they want to direct the flow of resources to themselves so they can increase it. Right? And make a profit. By the way, what did she do with her profit? So her husband runs a Govinda's restaurant, which sometimes makes a profit and sometimes breaks even and sometimes is a loss. It's primarily a preaching project, and it's one of, from what I've seen, one of the most successful preaching projects anywhere in the world. So her boutique business would make up any deficiencies in the restaurant. If the restaurant was breaking even or getting low, she'd make up the difference. She paid for one of Indrajumna Swami's tours in Australia. So I think it was like $70,000. And she contributed $500,000 to the TOVP, among other things. So remember we talked about how people in this field are the main givers of charity because they have the most wealth? So you'll also see in the dharmic expertise, understanding the flows, bring to themselves, make a profit, give resources to the society, and give charity to the society. Now this is very important, and it's something that we'll really touch on tomorrow about what happens when you're in the wrong field. These people always put their oxygen mask on first. They always make sure that they are making a profit. Otherwise, is their business sustainable? No. Is it regenerative? No. Are these people generous? Yes. But first they have to be making a profit. That is a different kind of generosity to I give everything away and I have nothing left. Yeah? It's a different kind of generosity. It's, yes, I'm going to be very generous, but I have to make sure my work is sustainable and regenerative so I can keep being generous. Understand? And that looks to other people like greed. Yes, people in other fields look at it and say, you're greedy. Remember we talked about this? You're greedy, you're profit-minded, but they're not. Huh? Well, Bali Maharaj is not in this field. Now, the people in this field, they look closely at the specifics of every possible investment. They're able to understand cash flow, pitfalls, unreliable dependencies, see how everything affects the flow, They want to make sure that their business can maintain itself when there's good times and when there's bad times. Now, I have another devotee friend who had a very, very successful business, and then here in Europe, and he got a huge order from someone in another country. That person received the products, selling like computer supplies, but didn't end up paying him the money. And because it was such a huge order, his business went bankrupt. But he was gradually able to take things and build it up again. And I was just talking to him, and he says, I'm even more successful now than I was before that. Or I never knew them, they died before I was born. But my great aunt and uncle, the aunt after whom I was named, so they were running a chain of hotels. And then in the big stock market crash of 1929, they lost everything. And the story that I was told growing up was my great aunt, she had saved $50,000 in cash, which today would be worth, I don't know, a lot more than that. And she said, I have these $50,000. And from that, he rebuilt the whole business. So being able to understand how I can tap into this flow of how resources are moving in the world. And we talked about this already, under consuming the harvest. Always saving some seeds for the next, for the planting. Always making sure there's something in reserve. This is kind of the essence of what it means to be regenerative. And these are people who are energized by the concept of building wealth for society. These people really want to see society become wealthy and prosperous. So again, I'm going to use my son as an example because I know him well and it's just such a simple thing. But he said to me, Mata, by the time I was 22, I had generated more money for society than you and my father spent on raising me. And that was one way that he felt that he was successful. Now, they have three children, and he also said to me, Mata, if you raise good children, they will make a bigger financial contribution to society than you invested in their care. And that's how you know that you have contributed to society. Now, that's not how I think about a contribution to society, but I found that very interesting, that he's thinking of my contribution to society, myself and to my children, is to take whatever has been invested in us financially and make it more. Okay. And again, these are the fundamental questions they ask. Is it sustainable? Is it regenerative? Okay, so I'd like you to take a couple minutes and think and write down, to what extent does this describe you and to what extent does it doesn't? How much do your values resonate with this? And how much do they not? I guess the other thing we should say, and this is a general rule, is that our initial proclivities until we've learned the Dharma, may come out in a way that's annoying to others. Also, if people around us have a different field, then they may be very critical of our values. So one way you can notice this, have people criticize you and saying, oh, you're too much into money, or you're too much into profit, or you're too materialistic. Have you had these kind of criticisms? Have you criticized yourself like that? Yes?
I have a question. How does this apply criticism, let's say, in terms of parents and children? Because, like, we often have a problem that parents want some idea for their children.
This is a huge point, and we go into this in depth in our book, that if your children are in a different field from yours, then you may end up being very critical. Yes? Also, when someone doesn't have the dharmic expertise, they may show these tendencies in a way that are negative. And they may be criticized for them. And they may end up doing self-criticism for them. Follow? How many grain ceremonies have you been to where people were upset when the child chose the money? I mean, let's think about this for a minute. You know, we have this kind of prejudice in our movement about people in this field. And I think even in the world in general, there's a bit of a prejudice about, you know, the big business, the big greedy businessmen. Yeah? So if somebody has this nature, they may feel some guilt and shame about it. They may have a lot of self-criticism. They may say, well, you know, Prabhupada says be satisfied with the bare necessities of life, and that's not me, and I guess I'm just in Maya, and what am I going to do? We were at a Zoom meetings of various leaders in North America and ISKCON, and devotees were talking about what services they wanted to do, and there was this one man who said, you know, I think everyone should just be inspired to make a lot of money so they can donate significantly to ISKCON's projects. And I thought, well, I know what field you're in. And he said, that's just the most enlivening. He said, I love giving money to ISKCON. I mean, I like spending money on ISKCON projects too. I like giving in charity to people. But I would never say that's the main thing that I like to do. And what was really funny to me about it is he thought, we have to inspire everybody to be like this. We have to teach everybody to go out and earn a lot of money so you can give tons of money to the movement. And I thought, that's not going to happen. But we may have this tendency that has come out in ways that people criticized us for. And yes, in certain cultures, in certain families, everybody's supposed to be a doctor. You know, if you're not a doctor or a lawyer, then it's all useless. Actually, I just finished taking a course in how to design online courses. And the woman who teaches it, who's become a multimillionaire, she's Korean, and she said how her parents couldn't relate to the fact that she wanted to be a big business person. Her father was always trying to get her to be a scientist. And he just could not relate to this at all. She said, my parents still don't understand what I do. She said, I'm one of the most successful female entrepreneurs in the world, and they just don't understand it, and they don't relate to it. By the way, in our ISKCON movement, we might think that on our ISKCON-owned farms, people are working in this field. They usually are not, because they don't own the land. Yeah, they don't own the land, and they're not using the land and the milk products to make a profit and to feed the world. You follow? So most of the people working on our farms that are collectively owned, what field are they working in? Artistry. Yes. And I know of one couple who are definitely in this field of resources. And for 15 years, they were living on a devotee farm that had cows. Can you see? There's no way. Absolutely no way. Can you sit someplace where you can actually see? Yeah. I did this for you to see it, you know. So, I mean, if you don't want to see it, then it's like, I mean, I had a lot of fun making it, but. So anyway, he was in charge of the cows, of the Goshal, for 15 years. The cows, bulls, oxen. But he never felt that he had the power, the autonomy, right, to develop it the way he wanted. You follow?
Yes.
And he kept trying to get that, but he couldn't. It wasn't available to him. He couldn't get that autonomy. And it was a big thing, you know, when he finally moved out, he was told that he was a nonsense and he was leaving his service and this was so terrible and how could he do this? And it was really heavy. And it shook his faith in his guru. I mean, it was very, very heavy.
Does that mean they need to be self-employed? Or
yes. Absolutely.
All of that.
Pretty much, yes. Yeah, at least at some point, maybe not initially. Maybe initially you work as part of, but you could have this, you could be in this field working for someone else's business if you're also helping to run the business. Could be a partnership, could be a team. Anyway, he and his wife finally started their own farm. You know, but that was after probably 5 or 6 years of great agony. Because even though he was taking care of cows and taking care of the land, he wasn't doing it in his field. Is this clear?
Yes.
Yeah? All right. I can think of another devotee I know, a very good friend of mine, who decided that he wanted to promote ahimsa milk in the world. And he said, just like organic produce has become a thing, that people pay more for organic food, and it's, people understand it pretty much all over the world. He wanted to make ahimsa milk a thing like that, where people would go to a shop and say, hey, do you have any ahimsa milk? So he decided, instead of working with devotees, that he would work with non-devotees who already had a dairy and start to move them towards an ahimsa model and then sell the milk as a subscription, that people would get a milk delivery. He got so much criticism, including even from his spiritual master. Just so much criticism. And he ended up developing it. It's become an extremely successful model. And people get ahimsa milk delivery. And not only has it been very successful from a business point of view, but it's also been very successful from a preaching point of view. That many, many people visit the farm and other dairies are starting to look at that model and see if they can copy it and start instituting it. And if it keeps going, probably in 20 or 30 years, we will have this replicated so that you can go into grocery stores and, you know, you'll see organic milk, you know, grass-fed, organic, and you'll see ahimsa. But yeah, at first it was like, why do you want to do this? Why do you want to do a business? Yeah? Okay, field of artistry. So sometimes these are people who are always taking things apart and putting them back together. Sometimes they take them apart and can't put them back together. Now again, this is different from a hobby. Again, a lot of us have hobbies in the field of artistry. Like when I was a child, I used to make clay sculptures all the time. I had this whole village of people in clay sculptures. But wanting to do a craft, wanting to use tools, wanting to use your body as a tool. If people want to be in the performing arts, this may show up as a desire to be on stage. And again, people may get criticized for this. Why are you always showing off? So there's a very famous person. He has a YouTube video. And I should have that in my presentation. But anyway, I don't. So he talks about how when he was going to school, he was always getting in trouble with his teachers for doing this. Stop that noise. Stop that noise, right? And he was always getting in trouble. When he was 10, the teacher said to him, see me after class. And he's like, oh, no. And he says, I'm in trouble again, right? The teacher says, no. He said, I have a gift for you. And what did he give him? Gave him drumsticks. He became one of the most famous drummers. Right? As another true story, a little girl in school, she could never sit still. She was always jumping out of her seat and running around, and swimming around, not being able to do her work. And there was a meeting of the teachers and the principal and the parents, and they said, maybe she needs medication so she can sit still, or maybe she needs extra tutoring. And one of the teachers said, I have an idea. So he asked this little girl, go sit in that room, and then he put on some music, and they were just like looking through a window, and the girl gets up and started dancing. And he said, she's not sick, she's a dancer. And she became not only a dancer, but a famous choreographer. She became the choreographer for the Broadway musical Cats. So often again, this shows up as a problem. You're always drawing pictures in your notebook when you should be studying. Right? You're supposed to be doing your studies, instead you're building a birdhouse. You know, making things, building things, fixing things, even necessarily when you're not supposed to be doing them. Now, that we all have some of this, but if this is your main satisfaction, I made that, I fixed that, I cleaned that, I helped somebody. To make a painting that hangs on somebody else's wall. This really hit me when I was many years ago in St. Petersburg, and we were staying in the home of some devotees. They were not there. They just let my granddaughter and I stay there. And all over the walls were original devotional oil paintings from one artist, from this one artist, Yugala Priya. But, and oh, the artwork was so beautiful. She has this particular technique of using raised paint and glitter, and oh my God. I had seen prints of her artwork before, you know, in electronic pictures, but to see the original paintings, it was just astonishing. But their whole house was filled with these paintings. And I thought, okay, if I'm the artist, I mean, I wouldn't do that. I'd keep the original painting in my house. I'd give you a print. I'd give you a copy. But I wouldn't give you the original painting. I thought, in this one house was like 15 or 20 paintings. How much time each painting took. She might never see them again. The essence of this field is service. And this field is very, very close to the mood of bhakti. Which is, I think, one reason why sometimes ISKCON leaders, if they want you to get a mood of service, force you to work in this field, even if it's not your field. Does that make some sense? I think, well, I want you to get a service attitude. So you have to do work in artistry. But it's like, I'm not in artistry, I'm in resources. Look, I can make enough money to have you fix up the whole property. No, go plant the flowers. You'll learn service. But this field is service is its integral part. I'm taking a humble role. Again, I paint a painting, it goes in your house. I'm taking a background role and a love for this. Maybe doing service on a one-to-one personal level, taking care of, you know, some people who are sick, fixing some things. So my granddaughter's in this field. She's always looking around, what can I make beautiful? What can I fix? What can I make work better? How can I make something work better that people will be happy? I had this desk that was given to me, and I'm very grateful someone gave it to me, but it was a typical cheap factory-type desk that, you know, after a few months is falling apart. She said, Grandma, I want to make you a really nice desk. So she, you know, she sourced the wood, and she researched how to make a desk, and she built it from scratch, you know, and she'd show me, okay, I did the drawers like this, and look, when you pull the drawer out, it'll be straight, and it won't fall down, and you'll really like that, Grandma, when you put your things in it. It won't fall down, and it'll be straight, and it's, and look, Grandma, over here, you know, if you put your papers, everything will be flat. And her great happiness is coming in my room and seeing it's in my room. That's the general mood of this field. Now, especially, you're going to get criticism if you're in this field and your family wants you to be ambitious and make a lot of money. The people in this field are not interested in making a lot of money. They're interested in beauty and function. And they're very satisfied people. If you're naturally in this field, you may have been criticized for being too satisfied. Why aren't you more ambitious? Now, especially families that live in poor countries or places where people have to struggle, they may try to push their children out of this field if this is their natural field. I have one devotee friend who grew up in India, and his parents wanted him to be a scientist. And, you know, when he was 50, he said, you know what, Urmila, I want to be a musician. And now I'm 50, and I'm going to go be a musician. He said, but my parents would never have accepted that. And whenever I would want to play music, they would say, stop wasting time and do your studies. Stop wasting time and do your studies. I had one woman tell me this also. She said, my father told me, don't bother about learning any kind of crafts, just study. She said, now I am 30 years old, I don't even know how to cook. You know, so there's often people will push someone away from this field. All right, what is the dharmic expertise? Honesty. The Shastra says honesty is one of the main symptoms of dharmic expertise in this field. If somebody's going to fix your plumbing, what's the main thing you want from them? That they're honest, right? You ever worked with a cheating builder? I have. Oh, boy. And you suffer from that for a long time. You end up paying 10 times as much to fix all their cheating as you would have had to pay to work with an honest person in the beginning. So honesty. Honesty about what they're producing, what is the quality, what is the fair price. And one of the aspects of dharmic expertise in this field is they're satisfied with getting a fair price. They're satisfied. You know, they do their work. Their main interest is the craft. They're taking money because they have to take money to pay their bills. But their main interest is the craft. And in being supportive and in doing service. Oh, I put in a heating system that works well for you. One of our testimonies is from one lady devotee in Europe who works as a plumber. And she works with boilers. And she repairs boilers. And I said, what do you love about your work? She said that I can make sure people have heat and hot water in the winter. And she said, sometimes I'll sit for a couple hours after I finish my job and talk to people about their life. And, you know, maybe I can talk something about Krishna, but I really feel I'm doing Krishna's work by making sure that people have heat and hot water in their life. And if you said to her, do you want to be rich? She'd say, why? And really great satisfaction in the work. So there's a verse in the Bhagavatam in the 11th canto about an arrow maker who is so absorbed in making his arrow perfectly straight that when the king and his retinue, you understand retinue, his group, the soldiers and ministers that follow him, they were walking by. Do you think they make a lot of noise, the king and his retinue? The king is coming, the king is coming, and very colorful and noisy. He didn't even notice it. He didn't even notice it. So absorbed in the craft. Okay? And he's actually, this arrow maker is given as one of the 24 gurus what we can learn about full absorption. As I said, this particular field is very close to bhakti. The mood of service and the mood of full absorption in your craft. You know, people in this field are not generally managing a whole lot of other people. If they do some business, it's a small one. You know, maybe you have a little plumbing business, right? You have a little roadside stand selling your jam, or you have a little bakery selling your bread, but you're not into some big business. So the love of one's craft, the satisfaction of giving a needed essential service, and the dignity of a job well done. You'll hear people talk about work in this field as being dignified. You're doing an honest day's work for an honest day's pay, and that's very dignified. You all understand what that means? Yes? Now, it's worthwhile, it's worthy, it's valuable. So people in this field are very, very rarely contributing to society in some big, splashy way. Sometimes, but not usually. And they're satisfied with, you know, I can do a good job to a high level of quality that's honest, that's giving beauty and support to society, and I can live a simple, honest life. And this is worthy. It's respectable. Because remember, what's the prejudices people have about this field?
Lazy,
uneducated, dirty,
low class.
But people with dharmic expertise, they feel it's worthy. What I've done is worthy. I fixed your plumbing problem. Right? I
fixed your car.
I fixed your car. I've done something that's worthy in society. Yes? Now, something very important, I mentioned this before, but very important to remember, is people in this field are satisfied if they have basic physical comforts of life. They're not, they might say, sure, I'd like to get a lot of money, but they're not usually willing to work hard to make a lot of money. You follow? Somebody in resources, they're willing to work really, really hard to make a lot of money. Even harder than necessary. They could get plenty of money in 3 days of working and they'll work five to make more. Someone in artistry would never do that. If a person in artistry, if they have a comfortable home, they have a, you know, loving partner, they have decent food to eat, you know, they can pay their bills, and they have a craft that they love, they're satisfied. They're satisfied with themselves, they're satisfied with their contribution to the world. In general, they're satisfied. All right, so the questions these people ask about their work, again, is it supportive and is it beautiful? And again, we can think of, you know, how much is this something that I tend to do? Are these the kind of things that I tend to do without being asked, without being paid, even if they annoy other people, even if they get me in trouble, even if it's not what the society around me is pushing me to do? Okay, field of ideas. So here again, we're looking at inclination. Loving to play with either language or mathematics to find out truth. What's true? What's real? Or it can be going into yourself. It can be people who, you know, one of my daughter's students in the Gurukula, I was teaching this in the Gurukula, and I was talking about that our inclinations can be seen by what we get in trouble for. And he said, I'm always getting in trouble with my parents for thinking. He said, my mother will say, what are you doing? I'm thinking. Go do something practical. We had, some years ago, we had a meeting of the Shastric Advisory Council in Italy, We were working on the ISKCON hermeneutics project, which was a major 3-year project. So we had a 10-day meeting there, and we figured out the basic framework, and then we divided it up, and each of the scholars took a certain area that they were going to work on their own for 2 days. So people were going to do individual work for 2 days, then come back together. And we only had 10 days there, and, you know, we had gotten money from the GBC to pay for the airfare and everything. It wasn't cheap, airfare, visas, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we come back after 2 days, and we're going around the room. What have you done? What have you done? And we got to one of our members. So what have you done? He said, I was thinking. And I remember sitting there going, huh, okay. But actually, his thinking was very valuable. He ended up contributing huge amounts to the project that had a very different perspective. And he ended up doing a lot of research, but he had to take the time to think. Yes? And again, it may not be language. It may be mathematics. It may be wanting to see what is the geometry of everything? What is the relationship of everything? How can I analyze things mathematically? How can I explain things in terms of mathematics? How can I explain truth using numbers? Or again, it may be in the arts. Yes. People see patterns in ideas and relationships. They love research and study, or they love meditation, introspection. Or it may come out in wanting to do a lot of worship. So what do you think I got in trouble for when I was 3 years old?
Teaching.
Teaching, yes. Who would you think I got in trouble in school? I was going to the preschool, the kindergarten. Who do you think I was teaching?
Teacher.
I was teaching the teachers, yes. So my teachers came, they contacted my parents, and they said, your daughter is a big problem because she's not playing with the other students. She's coming to us and telling us how to teach. So the first major book that I wrote as an adult was a 500-page book, Vaikuntha Children, How to Run a School and How to Teach. Now, because I got that complaint from my teachers, I ended up thinking that being a teacher was something bad and something wrong. And my mother especially would often say to me when I was growing up, stop teaching. So I thought this was a terrible, terrible thing in myself. Also, I got in a lot of trouble in school for asking questions, especially uncomfortable and difficult questions. I got in a lot of trouble I went to the Jewish Theological Seminary. I got in a lot of trouble from the rabbis for asking difficult theological questions. They told me, be quiet, don't ask that question. You're not allowed to ask that question. You know, so I was very much harassed for asking difficult questions. I was very much harassed for teaching. I was very much harassed for knowing things. You know, I'd be in school, the teacher would ask a question. You be quiet. Let somebody else answer. You always know everything. And I was very much criticized for this. Well, you think you're so smart. This is school. Aren't we supposed to be rewarded for being smart? I couldn't understand this. You know, as a child, I was so confused. It's like, don't you want me to learn what you're teaching? And I would finish my work early, and then I'd say, I'm done with my work. You couldn't be done with your work. You must have made a mistake. No, I'm done with my work. I said, can I read a book? No, just sit there. I'm like, this is school. Don't you want me to read? So the whole time I was growing up, I was criticized for learning quickly. I was criticized for teaching. I was criticized for asking difficult questions. Especially, I was criticized for pointing out when my teachers or parents were wrong, because I had done some research and found out that they were wrong. And so I never, ever, ever thought that I was a teacher. Does this all make sense to everybody?
Yes.
I thought that was something bad and evil in myself. I didn't see it as an inclination at all. So in high school, I was on the speaking and debate team. I was the state champion. Another year I was a district champion. And most of my friends became lawyers. And I knew I didn't want to be a lawyer. And you know why I didn't want to be a lawyer? No, because I thought the lawyers are not finding real truth. I thought they're just expert at arguing their side, and that's not how you find truth. You see?
Yeah.
What my interest was?
Honesty.
It was truth and wisdom. I wanted to, and I said, being a lawyer, I won't contribute truth. And then I thought, well, what talents? Then I asked the question, what do I like and what am I good at? And I thought, well, I like acting, and I'm good at acting. So maybe I should be an actor, and I'll talk about this more tomorrow, what that did to me. But so I started studying acting. I thought that's where I'm supposed to go. And by Krishna's great mercy, when I was 24, and I should say even before that, so when I was younger, when my oldest son was young, I was asked to teach little children. But I didn't know how. Nobody had ever taught me how to teach, and I thought teaching was evil. I mean, if I say that, it sounds ridiculous, but that's what I thought emotionally, right? And so I didn't know how to teach these children, so I just kind of watched them, and sometimes I would start to fall asleep because I was so bored, and I had no idea what to do with them. So I didn't know that that was my career. And a few years later, I met Jyotir Mai. By that time, our daughter had been born, and she had a son the same age, and she said, we need a school for the children. Would you help me? And I'm like, sure. And she trained me not only in the craft of teaching, but most important, she trained me in the dharma of teaching. She trained me in the mood, the attitude of teaching. And by that association, it was like something that was inside me was released. And I was like, wow, this is wonderful. You know, this is what I was made for. But it was until I was 24, I didn't know that I was good at it, and I didn't know that I loved it. If you'd said, what do you love and you're good at, I'd say, riding my bicycle. I would have said public speaking and acting. All right, the dharmic expertise. So the Bhagavad Gita lists these qualities as peacefulness, self-control, austerity, purity, tolerance, honesty, knowledge, wisdom, and religiousness. And the Bhagavatam also adds satisfaction, simple straightforwardness, devotion to God, and mercy. Now, these are also very important, just like the field of artistry. The people and ideas tend to be very satisfied. But the source of their satisfaction is radically different from those in the field of artistry. If people in the field of ideas may not even care about simple, basic physical comforts. In fact, they may not even notice them. What they're satisfied with is their inner life. The life, if they have a rich life of the mind and intelligence or inner life, then they really don't care much about anything else. They tend, again, not to be very ambitious. Now, devotees can be ambitious to preach in any field, but in artistry and ideas, people are not ambitious about their livelihood. Can you understand the difference? Yes. It's also very important about mercy. People in this field tend to be extremely forgiving and merciful. Remember that. That will be important for tomorrow.
Sorry, I have a question.
Yes.
Your schoolmates went on to become lawyers, etc.
Well, the other people in the speaking and debate club, they all became lawyers. Yes.
So were they not interested in truth and wisdom? Were they not in the field of ideas as much as you?
Correct.
So they were in the field. They are aware in the field of his partnership.
No, lawyers are in the field of
government.
Lawyers are in the field of government. Why are lawyers in the field of government? Justice. It's all about justice. Remember, government is it just, is it honorable? They're all about justice and honor.
Okay, so...
And some lawyers also fight. I mean, not physically.
Okay, but into justice, etc., you need to want to kind of establish justice. you need to want to be truthful. And I thought you said that those who are not just interested in the money that comes with being a lawyer rather than in establishing justice.
Can you repeat that?
I understood that you said that your schoolmates went on, you didn't feel attracted towards that, even though they were, because you were more interested in truth than...
I saw that being a lawyer would not help establish truth. It would establish justice, but not truth.
All right.
Lawyers establish justice, but not truth.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I was trained in debate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I was trained in public speaking and debate. I can create a class on any subject in about 30 seconds. Literally, I was trained like that for years. I was trained in debate. Prabhupada talks about how Lord Chaitanya was trained in debate, and in his day, that was the general training. I mean, Mahaprabhu is the top of the top of the top. It said that Lord Chaitanya could present any argument, then he could present arguments against that argument, then arguments against that argument, then arguments against that argument. So that's kind of the way we were trained. So I was trained to listen to a point of view of someone talking very, 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 very fast, like this fast, because I had to say it in 8 minutes, and I wasn't talking like that. So I was trained to listen to them talking at that speed, take notes about what they were saying, also take notes about how I would defeat that point, and take notes about what authority I would quote, and then I had a big box of quote cards. You know, we had no computers then. So I'm listening, I'm pulling the cards, I'm listening, I'm taking notes, I'm thinking, taking notes of my defeating arguments and pulling the quote cards. And then I have 2 minutes while my partner does a cross-examine to plan my speech and get up and speak. And we were trained that we could speak on either side of an issue. So I could take an issue and I could argue in favor of the issue and I could argue against the issue. And what I argue, I knew how to defeat all my own points. You follow?
Yes.
I could present points very convincingly and I could also tell you what was wrong with all of them. And I had authorities on both sides. And I had to be aware of what arguments everybody else would create. And I had to have arguments ready to defeat them. And I had to have quotes on both sides. And we would switch sides. You do a debate, you're on this side. And then the next hour you would do a debate and you're on the other side of the same point. And then you would win the debate based on your skill, not on truth. Nobody was looking for truth.
Persuasion.
Hmm?
You persuade people with your...
Yes. And what I realized from doing that for 3 years is that if you have enough skill, you can defeat any point of view. If you're trained in this skill, you can defeat anything. And you can defeat people with their own sources of authority. You can take people's arguments and their authority and you can turn it around to defeat them. I'm extremely good at this. I had a whole room full of trophies for this. But what I learned was that you don't find truth that way. You may be able to use this sort of skill to make sure that innocent people don't get put in jail. And make sure that criminals get punished. And make sure that people follow the law. But you are not going to establish what is true. So my other friends who were in the debating club, they became lawyers. I had no interest in becoming a lawyer. I'm interested in justice. I want there to be justice in the world. It's not that I want the world to be unfair. But I didn't want to dedicate my life to working for justice in the world. Now, at that time, when I was in high school, I had no idea that I could use those same skills as a researcher and as a scholar. I didn't know that. Nobody told me. And I was criticized. Right? I was criticized for being able to defeat other people and ask hard questions and bring up... You follow? I still am, actually. And so I never thought of using it in the field of ideas because nobody gave me any guidance as to how to do that. I had no idea what to use it for. And I pretty much thought I had to throw it away. I was mostly criticized for it. Yeah? Does that make some sense? And the main reason I didn't want to be a lawyer is I said, you don't know what's true. You just know who has the better set of craft. Who's the better arguer? They're the ones who win. The truth doesn't win. And I rejected it. I mean, that had something to do with my dedicating my life to Krishna consciousness also. That I said, you know, there's that famous verse that you're not going to find truth right from argumentation because every muni has their own perspective. Is that clear? Yes?
Yeah.
Yes? Someone else had a question? Yes?
I have life position in music. So this feel person feel truth or the truth? Because in this time you feel that it's not truth because it's not real. Because inside truth you feel that it's not truth.
No, not exactly. So we're debating, if I understand you correctly, tell me if I'm not understanding you correctly. Like, let's say we're debating, you know, like right now the United States decided to sell cluster bombs to Ukraine, if you keep up with the news. So you could debate, should the United States sell cluster bombs to Ukraine? What's the right answer? So in debate, you don't find the right answer. Somebody says yes, they should. Someone says no, they shouldn't. And you have who has the best argument. Who makes the best point. And you'd never come to a conclusion. There's no conclusion. There's no answer of truth. Do you follow
not
what I'm saying?
Debates, but in life. Every situation, you feel what is truth, what is not. It's more than other people. No?
No. No. It's just that what I want to do with my life is increase truth and wisdom in the world. That's the main thing I want to do with my life. That's the main way I see my contribution to society. It's not that I feel truth more than others. There may be a plumber who feels the truth much more than I do. It's not that I feel it more than others. It's that that's what I want to give. I don't want to make sure that you have prasadam and make sure that you have clean sheets on the bed and make sure that you have a ride to the airport. I mean, I want you to have those things, but I don't want to be the one to do that. I want you to be treated fairly and with justice by your authorities in ISKCON, and I want you to be treated fairly and with justice by the legal authorities. I want that very much, but I don't want to be the one who has to do that. Do you follow?
Yes.
I want those things. I care about them, but I don't want to have to do that work to do them. I'll work for years. I worked for 6 years with Rukmini to do this research, to write the book, to put this together. Why? So I can share truth with you. That's my interest. It's not that I know it more than you do or than somebody else does. That's not the case at all. I may know truth less than the person cooking the khichdi or the person driving the van. Is that okay? Yeah, we talked about how the dharmic expertise here is about mercy and forgiveness. So maybe these people may be dedicated to helping others mentally and emotionally to understand life and how things work. They may also be dedicated to understanding themselves. Like people who are full-time pujaris. They're not teachers. But what they're contributing is to an inner meditation on truth. That in one sense they're sharing with others by everyone coming and seeing the deities. They may take pleasure in helping others physically through medicine, how to become healthier, how to have your body in harmony with the world, in harmony with nature. These people usually like to collect knowledge, understand it, use it, and share it. Sometimes these people live in their heads without much concern for their own body and with little awareness of the world around them. Just like, remember, the person in artistry, they can be just fixed on their craft and they forget about the world. So the people and ideas, they can be fixed in their head and they forget about the world. Yeah. Scientists, religionists, the essence of everything, wanting to communicate philosophy, science, spirituality, values. Now, some of these people work in very, very small areas of knowledge. They research, you know, the particular migration habits of a particular bird. Right? Or they research, you know, the way that the geometry of football. And other people are going to be looking at the big picture of reality. Yes?
So, just a clarification. Not all those in the field of ideas are teachers.
No. No. Some are researchers. Some are writers. Some are musicians and artists and dancers. Okay. Some are meditators and worshipers and priests.
So, clarification. A researcher in the field of mechanical engineering, is that field of ideas or artistry?
Are they working as an engineer or are they researching about engineering?
Researching.
Then it's ideas. Okay. They're not actually working as an engineer.
And if they are like the same thing, what they learn?
If they're researching and applying it, then they're in artistry. If they're researching because they're applying it. Like you might, my granddaughter was researching techniques of sanding the desk. You might research, you know, how to have a particular musical instrument or researching something about acting, but you're primarily an actor and you have to do some research as part of your work. You know, the person who installed the heater in Tulsi's greenhouse in North Carolina, he had to do a lot of research to find a heater that didn't use any electricity, that was designed for a greenhouse that could be vented to the outside. So he had to do a whole lot of research, but he's not a researcher. But if you are a researcher, if you're researching engineering and you're not actually working as an engineer, then you're in ideas. Is that clear?
So just if you can be a researcher but not being good at it as a teacher, that means within the same field.
There's always quite a bit of variety within the same field.
Right. So if you find your field, doesn't mean that you find that specific variety in the knowledge.
Bingo.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Now, why is this important? There's a lot of variety within a field. All we have to do to be dharmic is stay within that field that fits our dharma. And what's really nice is if we're doing a particular job and that job goes away, there's not much need for it, we can find another job within the same field. Now, one reason we start off with the six kinds of prosperity is the six kinds of prosperity gives you more of an idea of the specificity of your career within a field. Yeah? And as long as you stay in the same field, and as long as you're still getting the kinds of prosperity that make you rich, you're fine. Even though you may go from being a traveling musician to being a wilderness tour guide. And you think, what do those two things have in common? But they have most of the same types of prosperity, and they're in the same field. Yeah? No, not everybody in this field is a teacher.
It happens at universities, sometimes you get some researchers, they come and give class, and you can tell they're not really, sorry to say, but they're not really good at teaching.
Yes.
PhDs. Mm-hmm.
Yes, often they're not. If we're going to be really, really honest, we have many people in our Hare Krishna movement who know the scriptures very well and are terrible teachers.
Yes.
It's one of my irritants. It's like, why don't we train the people who are teaching how to teach? We train the people in the kitchen how to cook. We train the people on the altar how to dress the deities. Why in the world do we not train our teachers how to teach? It's like, ah! One of my things in life. But yeah, I mean, one of my very, very good friends, she never finished her PhD for reasons that were not her fault. But she's a medical researcher. She works in a medical lab as a researcher. She doesn't teach. She doesn't even do a whole lot of writing. You follow? She researches, she does the calculations, and I mean, she is an excellent writer, but it's other people there in the lab that take the results from different people in the lab and put it up and write it into articles and publish. And even a lot of them may not teach. Then other people are looking at those results and they're using it. You know, you have doctors, pharmaceutical companies that are then taking their results and using it in practical medical work or teaching about it. I mean, interestingly, according to Shastra, one of the livelihoods in this field is just studying Shastra. Now, in Jewish culture, there was this idea that if a man wanted to just study scripture his whole life, that the whole community would support him and his family. And it was considered a very good deed if you married your daughter to a man like this, that was just going to study scripture. Now you say, well, what's he doing? He's not teaching. Okay, but you know what's really cool? When you want to know something about scripture, who are you going to go to? To those people. They're like, you know, cosmic librarians. I mean, I have a whole bunch of people like this that I consult with.
Human librarians.
Yeah, they're amazing. And you just know this is a person I can just ask, hey, where's this thing? I mean, not that you should always try to find it out yourself first. But if I've spent already, you know, 5 hours researching and I can't figure it out, then I'll ask them. They're just repositories of knowledge and wisdom, even if they're not actively teaching. Okay, so these people are usually systems thinkers. But unlike resources, whether understanding the systems of a particular flow of resources, or government, whether understanding the flow of people, and their aim is to control those systems. In government, they want to control the systems of people. In resources, they want to control the systems of resources. In ideas, they're not trying to control the system. They're trying to understand it so they can teach people patterns so that everyone else can be guided as to how they should act. Their main motives are things like balance, harmony, peace, and equilibrium. These people tend to feel themselves above day-to-day life. It's not that these people are in ideas, but you can think of the mentality of a sports commentator. They're not playing the game, they're just commenting on it. So people in the field of ideas often feel like that. I'm not playing the game. Right? Now, some people in the field of ideas are more active in life, but many of them are not. I'm not playing the game, but I'm commenting on it. I'm watching it. I'm seeing the patterns. I'm letting people know what the patterns are and how things are playing out. Again, a lack of ambition. Satisfied with having a simple garden in the backyard, but they don't want to start an agribusiness. They might, you know, they have one cow, one, maybe two. They're not going to start a dairy herd. I actually saw a marriage break up because of this. The husband and wife were both into keeping cows. She wanted one or two cows. He wanted a huge herd. And she's like, how are you going to take care of these cows? How are you possibly going to take care of these cows?
So were those two in different fields?
Yes.
So she was
actually in artistry and he was in resources. So both artistry and ideas tend to have this type of simplicity. But again, artistry tends to be satisfied with basic physical comforts, and ideas tends to be satisfied with mental intellectual comforts. Mental intellectual stimulation. But neither of these fields are ambitious. Again, if you're in one of these fields and you're a devotee, you may be very ambitious to spread Krishna consciousness. You may be very enthusiastic to expand Krishna consciousness, but you're not going to be ambitious and enthusiastic and expansive about your livelihood. Does that make sense to everybody? Yeah? Okay, and again, the main questions that people in this field ask about their work is it true and is it wise? Am I adding to truth and wisdom in the world? Remember we were talking about yesterday how many people criticize this as being the most useless and impractical field? Okay. I'd like you all to think with this one. You know, are there ways in which I've demonstrated this? It could be with language. It could be through mathematics. It could be through introspection.
The writer also?
Depends what you're writing about.
Literature.
Hmm?
I don't know. Stories.
About?
Krishna.
Could be. Are you writing it for the beauty or for the truth?
For the truth.
Then yes. If you're writing romance novels and detective novels, or you're writing, you know, the life of Marilyn Monroe, the true story behind Elizabeth Taylor, it doesn't have to be fiction. I mean, yeah. That's all artistry. You follow? Yes? So to what extent do we have these values? Okay, field of government. These people are concerned about fairness and rules. It's not fair. They're not following the rules. They're not doing what they're supposed to be doing. Wanting to make people happy.
All right.
Wanting to make sure that people have their rights, that people have everything that they need, not on a one-to-one level. Not like, you know, I'm going to go make sure this person at the hospital has their bandages and they're not like, but on I want to make sure people have what they need. So I don't know if I already told this or not, because I always tell it, so I can't remember if I told it here. Did I tell about the kid who was minding everybody's business? No, I didn't tell this to you. Okay. So I know this devotee kid, and the whole time he was growing up, he was always getting criticized. Mind your own business. His parents, his brothers and sisters, mind your own business. You probably heard that 10 times a day when I'd visit them. Mind your own business. Mind your own business all day long. And he always wanted to make sure everyone in the family followed the rules. Mommy said you can't do that. And mommy's just sitting there. She doesn't care. Mommy, you said he can't do that. Why are you letting him do that? Oh, it's all right. No, it's not all right. That's the rules. Why isn't he following the rules? That's not fair. Stop minding other people's business. Stop trying to be the parent. Go back and do your own work. And they went on Indrajumna Swami's Polish tour, and he became the second in charge of the Polish tour for that year. And they said he was one of the best managers they ever had, because he was really expert at minding everybody's business and making sure that everybody followed the rules. Yeah? Once when I was teaching a class, there were a bunch of little kids, 3, 4 years old in the class. And, I don't know, 5, 6 of these kids. And this one little girl was managing them the whole time. Where they should go, what they should do. So at the end of the class, I said, whose child is this? So the parents came up and they were like this. They said, we're always telling her not to be so bossy. I said, your kid is a natural leader. I said, what do you do? And they were both leaders. They were both in government. They were both leaders in government. Like, wow. And they're always telling their kid, don't be so bossy. Imagine that. These people often have a lot of courage. They often have a very tough skin. They often don't really hear criticism. If you try to criticize them correctly, they often just don't. It doesn't bother them. Just go on with whatever they're going to go on. They often have a take charge mentality. They're ready to fight, especially for higher principles. Can you see how this might get people in trouble? Yeah? And again, what are the criticisms of this field? You're bossy, you just want power, you just want to be a controller. You just want to take charge. When I worked as an assistant principal in a government school, there was this one little boy who got in trouble with his teacher, and there was a meeting called between the boy's teacher and his parents who were divorced, and the kid and myself. And the teacher was complaining. She said, whenever a guest comes to the classroom, this kid jumps up and says, welcome to our classroom, and starts showing them around. And I tell him, sit down. I'm the teacher. And whenever any of the other students had a problem, he jumps out of his seat. He makes sure he gets them a pencil. He sharpens their pencils for them. He helps them with their work. He makes sure that they have whatever. Did you get your book? And I get my. And I say, sit down. You're not the teacher. And I said, you know, maybe you should have this child the official class helper. It didn't work. They decided there was something wrong with him and he should see a therapist. Yes. So this is some of the inclinations of people in this field. One very, very good friend of mine was very aware, grew up in the movement, was very aware at a young age that he was in this field. He really wanted to protect others, really interested in justice, always studying about history and politics, and really liked weapons also. And when he got second initiation, his spiritual master and the other devotees said, okay, now you have to be a brahmana. And it killed him. It hurt him so much. He thought, that's not what I want to do. That's not what I want to be. Can you open that window a little bit so we get some cross, please? Yeah. Just a little bit. And Jada Madhari, he was talking to us, and he said that one of the happiest times in his life is when he realized, I'm not a brahmana. I am not a brahmana. I'm a kshatriya. With this tendency to want to take care of others, to want to provide for them, to want to provide all the infrastructure and the care. Yes?
Does that mean that when second initiation is given to devotees in a different field from ideas, they're going to struggle with Brahminical standards?
Ooh. So hopefully very, 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 very soon the GBC will publish the latest paper from the Shastric Advisory Council about the Brahma Gayatri Mantra. And we discuss extensively second initiation. That Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati was dealing with a situation in India where he was initiating people who were not from Brahmana families. And he was allowing them to do deity worship and temple worship. And the Jati Brahmanas, the caste conscious by birth Brahmanas, were saying these people are not real Brahmanas. And so Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati said, no, anyone who's a Vaishnava is a Brahmana. Our Srila Prabhupada also continued this preaching because he brought his non-Indians to India, or Indians who were not born in Brahmana families, and had them install deities and worship deities and do yagyas and do the kind of things that in India were only being done by born in a Brahmin family Brahmanas. So Srila Prabhupada often would use the word Vaishnava and the word Brahmana as if they were synonyms. So what do we mean by Brahmana in the Shastra? And and from our acharyas. So one meaning is someone born in a family of brahmanas, and you'll notice in the shastra there's a lot of understanding of field by birth. Yes? A lot. So if we talk about, you know, Jagai and Madai were born in brahmana families. So that word brahmana is used for how what family you're born into. It's also used for the way we're using it here. What is your guna and karma? What is your means of maintaining yourself? What is your dharma, bless you? What are your values? Then it's also used in the sense of, do you know Brahman? Do you know God? So the first thing has nothing to do with livelihood, what family you're born into. And the last thing has nothing to do with livelihood. You can be a taxi driver and know God. You can be a great king like Maharaj Yudhisthira and know God. Yes? Right?
Yes.
Yes. So in the sense of knowing God, in the sense of knowing Brahman, everyone in that sense, that's why I was talking about truth. To have a sense of truth and to be communicating truth can be there by anyone. And you could have people working in the field ideas who don't really know anything about absolute truth, right? It's their livelihood. And they're studying some field of knowledge that's not related to absolute truth. But here we're talking about how do you maintain yourself. Now, the good thing about Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati's preaching and Srila Prabhupada's preaching is that our international devotees have pretty much been accepted by the Brahmana community in India and by the Indian community. I'd say almost 100%. Not everywhere, not by everyone, but almost 100%. The bad thing about it is a lot of confusion among us. That we get very confused as to what in the world is a Brahmana. Because it's used in those three different ways. Okay? Is that all right for a fairly simple answer?
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Yes.
All right, so we looked at the propensity in government. Now we're going to look at government expertise. Oh, no, sorry. So we're still looking here at propensity. Being goal-oriented, being decisive, being determined. Again, being systems thinkers about people. Being aware of the flow of people in the world. Looking at expertise. To intuitively understand and grasp emerging trends and needs throughout the area that they govern. This is a real problem in a lot of our ISKCON management of people who are not actually in this field. They don't see the emerging trends until they're long past adoption by the society. We were one of the last people to produce books as e-books. We were really like late adopters of e-books. Kirtan. We had all these impersonalists doing kirtan and we don't even notice until it's like a big thing and the big kirtaneers in the world are impersonalists. And then we're like, oh, maybe people are into kirtan. Maybe we should do something about that. So people who are expert in the field of government, this is the kind of thing they're looking for. Emerging trends in society. What are people moving towards? How are people doing things? How are people getting their needs met? Right? They can like sense the system and they know how to move and manipulate the resources of the system and the people in the system in order to tap into these. Now, the Bhagavad Gita lists the qualities of those who work in the dharmic expertise as heroism, power, determination, resourcefulness, courage in battle, generosity, and leadership. Now, remember we said there's leaders in all four fields, but these are the leaders of society. And the Bhagavatam adds, dynamic power, bodily strength, determination, heroism, tolerance, generosity, great endeavor, and steadiness. So these are the heroes. Now, unlike, remember in resources, what did they do with their oxygen mask? They put it on first. These people are the opposite. There's a building on fire. Everyone's running out of the building. Where do they go? Into the building. Now, they put on their protective gear if they have time. They run into the building. There's a crazy person shooting people. Everybody runs away from the shooter. Where do these people run? Towards it. Arjuna had a son called Abhimanyu. Manyu means fighting, battle. Abhi means toward. Running toward battle. Nobody else does this. It's only this field that they really run toward danger. They have a mood of sacrificing their own security for others' protection and running into danger. Others don't do this. People in the field of artistry, they're very much attached to their own security. They are not going to put themselves at risk to save others. I mean, they might if they're, you know, on the street and somebody's fallen in the water. But as a general thing, that's not what they're going to do. People in resources, they're going to make sure that they have a profit and they have something to keep their work sustainable. People in ideas, they're kind of detached. They're the sports commentators like that, going, oh, look. This is what happened in the Bhagavatam with Vena. You know this story? Right? Those in the field of ideas, they said, oh, there's no king. That's a problem. Oh, well. Okay, I guess we better. It's actually becoming a problem. Maybe we should do something. Okay. Vena's here. Anga's gone. Vena's here. What do you think, minister? Should he be the king? Yeah, okay. You're the king. Bye-bye. We're going to go back to our study and our research. You know, and then they heard, oh, Vena's causing a big problem. He's stopping all religion. And then they came and said, can't do this anymore. Guy was dead. Now, the thing was that even though Vena was a bad ruler, spiritually, materially, he was very strong, and so there were no thieves, there was no crime. So the people in the field of ideas, they go back to their study and their hermitage, and then they're seeing, it's in the Bhagavatam, they see a dust cloud. There were so many thieves running around from village to village, they were making clouds of dust. And they're like, what's going on there? And they're like, oh no, you know, we killed the king, and there was no other king, and so now there's a problem. So they go down, and then they use their mystic power, and they churn his body, and they produce Prithu and Archie, and they say, okay, you be the king and queen. Bye! So they're the detached watchers of the thing. But in government, these are the only people who are running towards them. This is going to be important for tomorrow. Yes? They're also, they work to prevent danger. So this is one point that my good friend who's in this field always makes. That if every day you're killing a tiger, somebody may ask you, why do you keep running into tigers? Your job should be to prevent tiger encounters, not kill them. So people who are really expert in this field, they know how to prevent people from getting into danger. They'll fight if necessary. And Krishna says that they're happy if fighting opportunities come unsought for them. They're very enthused. Oh, I get an opportunity to fight. But they don't look for fights. They try to preserve peace in society and protection in society, so fighting is not necessary. But if it's necessary, they'll run into the danger. They inspire others and command respect. There's a sort of charisma and positive outlook. They'll use their strength to protect innocent people. But, and this is a point Prabhupada makes about Arjuna, their general nature is tolerant and generous. They're not harsh or brass people unless it's needed for fighting. They'll only use power and force when everything else fails. This is the people who actually have the Dharma. But they're very generous. They want to make sure they collect money and then they give it out again. Someone who's following the Dharma, if the people are in need, they will empty their storehouse. Should people and resources ever completely empty their storehouse? No, but here they will. We have stories like this in the Shastra. People are in need. They go to the people in the field of government and they give everything. They will even give all of their own personal wealth to help people in need. They're extremely generous. Some people in this field may be very interested in studying. Some of them, but they're, if they do, they're going to study more practical than theoretical, and they're probably going to study things like history, law, politics, martial arts, morals, ethics, justice. But some of the people, some of the people in this field are very studious, and they will fight tirelessly for principles. And as we said, these are like the big parents in society, and Prabhupada makes the point many, many times that they not only protect the people, but they see all the living beings in their area as their citizens. So they will also make sure that the plants, the animals are protected. I mean, the people and resources are protecting the animals directly, but in government they're making sure that it gets done. And certainly it's the people in government who are going to protect the wild animals. And they're going to protect the forests. That's not going to be done by anybody else. They're going to make sure that the whole ecosystem is in balance. All right, and again, what are their questions? Is it just and is it honorable? They really have a high regard, not for honor in terms of prestige, but honor in terms of doing the right thing. Following the rules, following the law. And again, we looked at what kind of prosperity they create for society. This is not what we talked about on the first day as far as what am I getting from my work. But this is what prosperity are they providing for others. The people in the field of artistry provide Shri for others. The people in the government provide Yasha. They provide community, yes? And they provide Virya. They provide health and strength. Resources, they provide Aishwarya, and they also actually provide some Virya. In ideas, they provide Vairagya and Dhyan. Okay, any general discussions on the nature of the people in the fields? Questions, discussions?
A question. From your presentation, I was thinking that for example, somebody is giving a talk and he might be a leader or a charismatic speaker, he belongs to a specific one of the four fields. As the example you gave before of the GBC meeting, this devoted leader from North America saying, oh, everybody should give money to his company.
It wasn't a GBC meeting, it was a meeting of leaders in North America.
But anyway. Okay, sorry. So probably, if we have such a personality giving a talk, it would be difficult for him to be inspiring to those who belong to different fields. Is that correct?
There's a Sanskrit saying, Atmavan Mandate Jagat. We think everybody's like us. And sometimes I bring up embarrassing things about myself, but I hope that that helps other people to feel comfortable. So when I first became a Gurukul teacher, I thought that I was going to train all the children to have my particular type of mental processing. So I learned many things from that. First of all, that most people don't want my particular type of mental processing. Second of all, that even people who want it, most of them are not able to do that. And third of all, that everybody has their own glory and their own talent, and that if everybody thought like me, this world would collapse. We need everybody's talent and everyone's personality and everybody's type. And for me, it was learning about personality types that really opened up my thinking. And it's embarrassing that it took me as long as it did to do that, that everybody's beautiful in their own way. There isn't a one ideal type of being. It doesn't exist. That's not Krishna. And I bring up these examples all the time. Every snowflake is different. You don't see much snow here in Spain.
Yes.
You do, in some places?
Not particularly here, but 20, 30 kilometers from here, yes.
Okay, so some of you have seen snow? Yeah?
Yes.
Every snowflake is different. Why? Who looks at every snowflake? Who cares? How inefficient. Why not just have them all be the same? Why does he make every snowflake different? every grain of sand. Google magnification of sand and be amazed. Every grain of sand is a work of art. I had a devotee argue with me about this once. I was so happy I defeated him. And he said, is every grain of sand a work of art? I said, yeah, look it up. And he looked it up and he said, you're right. And I'm like, yep. They're all beautiful. Look at any plant. Take a plant, any plant. Oh, we have some, well, here's been, there's no two leaves on the same plant that are the same. Isn't that weird? Buy a plastic plant, it's not like that. On the same plant, every leaf is different. Every fruit is different. Every flower is different. Every petal on the same flower is different. Take three plants of the same species. They're different. Our God is a variety God. He's extreme variety God. Like, way over the top variety God. I'm like, do you need that much variety? Really? Every leaf has to be different? Every grain of sand? But we have a tendency, Atmavan Manya Tejagat. We tend to have one of two problems. Either we think we're great, or we think we're terrible. If we think we're great, we think I'm great, and everybody should be like me. And I'm going to judge everybody according to my standards. My way, you know, my ways of feeling rich are spiritual, and your ways of feeling rich are selfish and materialistic. The dharma of my field, that's worthy, and that's important, and that's spiritual. And the dharma of your field has all these problems. And you should all be like me. Then there's the other problem where we don't like ourselves. And where we're trying to be like somebody else. Oh, I wish I could be more of a leader. Oh, I wish I was more ambitious to make money. Oh, I wish I was more intellectual. Oh, I wish I was more this. Oh, I wish I was more that. And what each society tends to do, what each family and each group of people, is they tend to have some stereotyped idea of the best person. You follow? Here it is. Here's our generic best person. How do you line up with that? And then people either try to force themselves to be that, or they feel bad about themselves, or they rebel and say, sorry, I'm going to be what I am. And this happens in our Hare Krishna movement too. We have an idea of the good devotee. And we have an idea of the good sannyasi devotee, the good grihastha devotee, the good male devotee, the good female devotee, the good ashram resident. Ta-da! And you read the scripture and you're like, wait a minute, Draupadi doesn't fit that. She doesn't fit. She's arguing with the king in open court. Like, that's not, something's wrong with that generic good person thing. So because we have these sort of prejudices, we often try, like this devotee who said, we should train everyone to make a lot of money because the most wonderful thing is to give money to the temple. Or I know one temple president that said, the most wonderful service is dressing the deities. Everybody should be dressing the deities. And I'm like, no. You'll hear this in Bhagavatam classes. Everybody should study Srila Prabhupada's books for 2 to 4 hours a day. And you should study them like this. This is the correct study technique for Srila Prabhupada's books. Have you heard this kind of thing?
Yes.
I was at a women's retreat in New Zealand, and they asked me to speak about how to study Prabhupada's books. So there were 20, 25 ladies there. And I had everyone sit in a circle, and I said, I'm not going to tell you how to study Prabhupada's books. And they were pretty much all disciples of the same guru who was very strong. You have to study Prabhupada's books every day. So these were people who really studied Prabhupada's books. And we asked each person, how do you study Prabhupada's books? How do you study Prabhupada's? One of them said, I make the verses into poetry. One of them said, I take the verse in purport and turn it into questions and answers and put it on my blog. One of them said, I look at the Sanskrit in the verses and I find the words that I know and I find other verses that have the same word and I make connections between the verses. I've heard people get up in class and say, everyone should chant japa like this. Have you heard that? So this is our tendency. Everyone should serve like this. The service that I do or that I love, everybody should do it. And what's wrong with you? You don't like that? Boy, you're in Maya. You want to do what for Krishna? Yes.
It's kind of ironic sometimes because in the Mangalarta, in the Guru Vastakam, one of the verses says that the Guru engages you according to your propensity, you know, and you're describing both of it.
And it will look different.
Yeah.
It will look different and it will be bewildering to us. And we'll think, how come you're so into buying weapons? Like, what's your thing with this? You know? Like, don't you have enough knives and guns and axes already? It's like, what's your problem? One time, I mean, I worshipped Shaligram for many years, but I one time said, why would someone want thousands of Shaligrams? And they looked at me and said, why would someone want thousands of books? And I said, oh, okay. You know, it's we're different. And Krishna loves that. Krishna loves that. Krishna is called by Rupa Goswami Akhila Rasamrita Murti. He is the form of all rasas. And we think of rasas that there's five, you know, there's neutrality, servant, friendship, parental. But within those, there's unlimited varieties. In Ujjwala Nilamani, Rupa Goswami details 350 or 360 different categories of Krishna's gopis and queens. And he says, this is just, there. Actually there's sub-sub and sub-sub, 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 sub-sub. And each gopi is ultimately her own category. And Sanatana Goswami says, he says in a commentary in the 13th chapter of the 10th canto, you know, when all the cowherd boys and the calves, they were Krishna, and they appear as Vishnu. You know that story in Brahma comes, and he sees all the living entities are worshipping each Vishnu form. And Sanatana Goswami says, the Lord has infinite qualities, and there are infinite jivas, and each jiva is especially attracted to one particular quality. And each jiva has a particular flavor of love that they feel for the Lord. There's no two friends or two gopis or two servants who are exactly the same. It's different. Like you think of an ice cream shop that has, you know, 31 flavors or 50 flavors or, you know, all the toppings you can put on pizza or something like that. So each of us is like our own flavor of ice cream for Krishna. Each of us gives Krishna a particular flavor of pleasure. And each of us gets a particular flavor of pleasure from our dealings with Krishna. Lord Brahma says, the Lord takes whatever form the devotee wants to worship him in. When Krishna married 16,100 queens, he expanded himself, but each Krishna was a little different according to how each queen wanted to see him. Okay, you ready for this? I'm going to end with this. So Krishna is enjoying the flavor of love of an infinite number of jivas simultaneously. He is an unlimited number of, you know, servants in neutrality and servitorship and friendship. And he's relishing the particular flavor of their love. It's like if you could eat a meal with an unlimited number of preps, with an unlimited number of flavors, and be able to enjoy and taste each individual flavor simultaneously. I read once about this, I think it was a neurosurgeon, who had a near-death experience. You know what that is? When you die and you leave your body and then you come back into your body. So in his near-death experience, he went to some higher realm, some celestial realm, and he said what he really remembered was the music that he heard thousands and thousands and thousands of voices all glorifying God. And he said that he could distinguish each individual voice singing in their own way, but that somehow all the voices came together in harmony, even though they were each singing individually. That's what Krishna is tasting all the time. All right, we're not done. We're not done. Anandam Buddhibardhanam. The Lord, right, there's an expanding ocean, right? Bhaktiula Bhaktisiddhanta says, the jiva is finite. How can the jiva taste an infinite ocean of bliss? When the jiva is connected with Krishna, the jiva tastes what Krishna is tasting. When we're in material illusion, we have a sense of separateness. And we have a sense that my way is, you know, if we like ourselves, we think our way is right. If we don't like ourselves, we think, I want to be like somebody else. And we have this idea that there's one or maybe two generic ideas of a good person. And that is so far away from what reality is. All right. Tomorrow we're going to see what happens when you try to be somebody you're not. So far we've looked at what it's like to be who you are. And tomorrow we're going to see what happens when you try to be what you are not. What happens when people work in the wrong field? And every time I've taught this, the response that I've gotten is that that is the most part of this presentation, where you really understand what are the fields, you really understand what are the people, and you really understand why did Krishna do it like this. And once again, whatever was good here is by Srila Prabhupada's grace. I love how he's holding that little flower. And whatever is bad here is mine. So anything that was good, I hope you can take. If something was wrong, please forgive me and ignore that. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.